We're going to begin with a woman who fights for the rule of law by defending the very people targeted by international sanctions. Most recently, she's been getting calls from Russians sanctioned over the Ukraine crisis. But Maya Lester, an international lawyer and British barrister, made her career successfully helping Iranian, Syrian, Egyptian, and Burmese clients get off targeted blacklists from sanctions over the past two decades. Lester says she fights for her clients without spending a whole lot of time worrying about who they are.
Sometimes we're not in the business of saying this is a wonderful person and he shouldn't be listed, although very often that is the case. It's usually a question of saying that what has been put forward by the European decision makers is either incorrect or it's insufficient to justify including someone on the list.
In general, do judges in home countries or sanctioning countries care whether the country had a good reason for putting this or that person on the list?
Well, they feel usually that it's not appropriate for the court to interfere with the purely political sphere. So the court will be less interested in should we have sanctions against Iran or Zimbabwe or Russia. The question they are interested in is, has due process been afforded to this particular individual? And so that usually comes down to if the person has put in evidence that what has been said about them to justify their listing is wrong, then the court is often interested in, well, what does the decision maker say about that? And do they have any evidence to show that actually what they were saying is correct? Or are the reasons that they've given sufficiently clear and comprehensible that someone actually understands the case against them? And if they wish to say that it's wrong, that they are able to challenge.
Now, you're suggesting that there might be some sort of internationally recognized regime of process when sanctions are coming down. I mean, is that the case? Do you get a notification? You have 60 days to respond to these international sanctions, or otherwise you're going to go on this list and then your assets are going to be frozen. And if you can't come up with the documents that you challenge them or fill them out or even open the letter or something like that, you're stuck.
Well, here's where it depends which regime you're talking about, because people talk about international sanctions, but actually usually the decision makers that impose sanctions are either the US or the European Union or sometimes the United Nations. And the particular process that's followed and the way in which it's possible to challenge a sanctioning really depends which of those regimes we are talking about. But each of them has its own rules of due process. And in no regime I know of do they give advance notice that they're going to put you on a sanctions list, for the very simple reason that the idea is the purpose of these asset freezing measures is to freeze your assets. And if you're told in advance that you might be listed, there is a risk that, of course, you will dissipate your assets.
So how can you ever have due process in a case where there's never any notification?
Well, the question, there is notification, but it's not notification in advance. So what used to happen in the case of the United Nations, for example, is that you would be added to the blacklist, which happened in very large numbers of people just after 9/11. Many people were added at the request of the United States to the Al-Qaeda Taliban UN list, without being given any reasons at all and without individual notification. Now, that is no longer the case. Now what happens in the European Union, and I think in the US, is that you are told, you are informed either by a letter or by some kind of public notice that you have been added to the list, and you are told, or you should be told, why. So you're given some kind of reasons. And the question that really the courts have been struggling with, particularly in the European Union, is what kind of reasons are sufficient? So how detailed do they have to be? Do they have to be supported by evidence and so on?
All right. So I'm a billionaire. And I know we can't really do this. OK, but I've got to go down this road. I'm a billionaire. I live outside of Moscow in some dacha, and I've received some disturbing information, and I reach out to you. From your perspective as a lawyer, what's an easy sanction to get around, and what's something much more difficult? And counsel me if you would.
Well, it depends what you mean by get around. I mean, we do two things. So one is we advise people on what exactly they are allowed to do and not allowed to do when they're on a sanctions list.
Right. So can I sail my boat out of the Mediterranean?
Well, it depends on which sanction we're talking about. At the moment, if we're talking about Russia, then what you're not allowed to do is have funds or any kind of economic resource made available to you in the European Union, and all of your existing funds held in the European Union are frozen, so you're not allowed to have access to them. And it would be a criminal offence for anyone to make funds available to you in the European Union. So there is nothing stopping you sailing your boat around Russia. The difficulty will come if you are someone who has been blacklisted. The restrictions are on what you can do when you're in the European Union or what EU citizens can provide you with. Now, if we were talking about, you know, Iranian citizens, then sanctions have gone much further, both in the US and the EU, than simply asset freezes. So there you would be in a much trickier situation where we'd be advising you on, you know, whether if you wished to route a transaction from an Iranian bank to a European bank, that's a very, very difficult thing to do now. But at the moment, as I say, if it's Russia, you simply cannot hold funds in the EU or have funds available to you.
Can I send my wife or my girlfriend to an ATM in Geneva?
Well, Switzerland is not in the European Union.
Right, okay. All right, good point.
That always catches people out. Well, usually now in the EU, people's family members are not automatically themselves listed. There has to be some good reason to put people's family members on the list. But certainly someone's spouse would not be able to go to the European Union and make funds available in London for the benefit of someone on one of those lists without being in danger of committing a crime.
What if my company has been seized on some level and I want to keep paying my workers?
Well, there has been so far very limited blacklisting of companies. The difficulty comes with dealing with companies where people who are on the list have a large interest in the company. So in other words, either what can happen is the EU can add, say, a bank or a company to the list. If they do that, then that company is under the same restrictions as I've just outlined for people. But there is also now a great danger of dealing with companies where they haven't themselves been listed, but say there is an oligarch on the list who has a great degree of ownership or control in the company, then again, they need to do their due diligence and find out whether a Russian company that they are dealing with is owned or controlled by someone on the list. Because if they are, then their sanctions will also bite to prevent people dealing with companies where listed people have an interest. And the same is true with U.S. sanctions.
Has this sanctions universe created an opportunity for some offshore banking system that really services people like this, that either is a problem or a help in your work?
I'm not aware of that. I do think what tends to happen is that if, for example, the EU imposes sanctions on, say, an African country or Iran or any particular country, it's quite natural that what that country will try and do is make sure that its trade is not disturbed. And that may involve that country doing a lot more trade with different countries. You know, I have heard that China, for example, is a beneficiary of some of the sanctions that the European Union has imposed, because a country subject to sanctions will say, fine, we can't easily do business with the EU, we'll do business with the Far East instead. So I think it's less a question of, you know, particular banking or tax havens, and more that flows of trade will naturally be affected by sanctions.
So the takeaway is sanctions, from your perspective, work?
The question is, work to do what? One of the concerns I have about sanctions, or one of the interesting things, is that you have to think about what are they actually trying to do. And what strikes me is that they are a pretty blunt instrument, namely usually asset freezes and travel bans, which are used as a way of foreign policy for countries like US or EU countries to try and avoid putting troops on the ground. But what they're trying to achieve is so disparate. So if you think about stopping the funding of terrorism, or trying to persuade a country to abide by the rule of law, or trying to persuade President Putin to act differently in Ukraine, or trying to stop nuclear proliferation, or even returning assets to Egypt. These are such different foreign policy goals that it's extremely difficult to measure whether sanctions are working or not working. And I'm really more concerned with whether sanctions are, when they're targeted at individuals, whether they do so in a fair way, rather than really whether they achieve their goal.
Maya Lester, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So even sanctioned oligarchs need lawyers, and if you are an oligarch on a target list, there is clearly someone you can call. Maya Lester is a Yale Law School graduate and a British lawyer specializing in sanctions. By the way, she's the daughter of a human rights attorney and an immigration judge.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.